The name's Billy Graham, Billy Sunday, Dwight Moody. And we could think of many others. We think of these as the giants of the evangelical revival movement, at least in our century, at least in our time. But who started it here in America? Here in America, we can think of the likes of John Wesley in Great Britain and how much influence John Wesley had on the revivalism of America. But who here in America is principally responsible? Who was the mind of the Great Awakening? We're going to talk about that during this first hour of Issues, Etc. And the question we will press toward is, when we have identified this individual, if this patriarch of evangelicalism were alive today to see evangelicalism in America, what would he say? The subject of our conversation is the leader of the First Great Awakening, Jonathan Edwards. We'll be talking with Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine in just a moment. In the second hour of the program, here on Issues, Etc., Pastor Tim Pauls will join us. We'll be talking about the church as a boat. We're not talking about flotation devices or getting the church out on the water. We'll find out what he means when he talks about the church as a boat. He's author of an article in a recent edition of Higher Things magazine titled Don't Drink the Water. And then later in the program, Ken Woodward joins us. We'll talk about U.S. presidents and religious convictions. He has authored a story in the latest issue of Newsweek titled Gospel on the Potomac. And if you've seen Newsweek, it's about Bush and God. The remainder of the program is open lines for your questions and your comments. Very recently in the Washington State House, not Washington, D.C., the Washington State House, a Muslim delivered the invocation for the Muslim House. I'm sorry, for the Washington House. And two lawmakers got up off the floor during the invocation. A Muslim imam delivering an invocation. I'll share what the invocation was with you in open lines. And two of the lawmakers stepped off the floor during that invocation. Interestingly enough, they did it for political rather than religious reasons. And a question I have for you during open lines is, if that this were to happen to, say, in the U.S. House of Representatives, a Muslim come there to deliver the invocation or the prayer opening that session of the House or that day's business of the House, what would you expect your elected representative to do, especially if they're a Christian? We'll talk about it during open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Chris Armstrong is managing editor of Christian History Magazine, published in Carroll Stream, Illinois. And the theme of the latest issue of Christian History Magazine is Jonathan Edwards, the warm-hearted genius behind the Great Awakening. Chris, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
Before we talk about Edwards himself, what was this period known as the Great Awakening?
Well, it's really tied to these events that we'll be talking about in Edwards' own Northampton, Massachusetts. This is a time, really begins in the mid-1730s, 1734, where he preaches a series of messages, and there's what we've come to know as a religious revival in his town, and it begins to spread outwards. Then again in the early 1740s, 1740 and 41, the fires had died down somewhat, and Edwards invited George Whitefield, the famous British evangelist, to come and preach a series there, not only in Northampton, but up and down the coast. And at that point, the revival becomes a national matter, and has become known by later historians and later students of the period as the Great Awakening. It wasn't a term that they used at the time, but it points to this phenomenon of people just becoming very serious about matters of salvation and, you know, desiring to go in great crowds and hear the gospel preached.
How would the average Christian, or for that matter, the average student of history, know Jonathan Edwards today?
Well, I think often folks have not heard much about Edwards. They may have heard his name associated with this period of the Great Awakening. The other thing that they may well have heard is that he once preached a sermon, which has been anthologized in many books of American literature, and therefore people have encountered it, say, in a high school course or something. And the name of the sermon is Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And there's, he uses, Edwards used the image of a spider suspended by a slim thread over the furnace of hell and only held up by the grace of God, but deserving, you know, of death as sinners. He was a stiff-backboned Calvinist preacher, and he made no bones about the reality of sin and the need for people of God's grace. I have to say, though, quickly, that this was perhaps one of a few sermons that he preached that are really that directly, I suppose we might say, of the brimstone and hellfire mode. Most of the time, he preferred to preach about, the bliss of communion with Christ, the wonders of heaven, and many more positive topics. However, none of those became anthologized, and so folks know him as that stern old Puritan preacher who preached Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
If I were sitting in the pews or on the benches of Jonathan Edwards' little congregation there in Massachusetts, when he preached Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, or when he preached it subsequently, if I understand correctly, the first time he preached it didn't get much of a reception, but the second time, what would I have seen? What would I have heard?
Well, he was known as a preacher of great eloquence, but he was by no means kind of in the barnstorming mode of perhaps some later revivalist preachers. He was he kept a fairly even tone. Some people have even described him as being fairly lackluster in his preaching. He kind of stared off at the bell rope while he was talking. He early on used notes and outlines, and then at one point in his preaching career decided that this was really kind of quenching the spirit, and he committed himself to preaching from a mental outline, but not from a piece of paper. But he really wasn't the sort of, people said about George Whitefield, again, this British evangelist, that Whitefield could pronounce the word Mesopotamia and the audience would dissolve into tears. Ben Franklin describes hearing Whitefield and having gone into a meeting convinced that he wasn't going to give a cent to the cause, and emptied his pockets by the time Whitefield had finished. This wasn't really the kind of persuasive mode that Edwards was working in. He was a very clear speaker in his presentation, again, not a dramatic preacher, I think.
So if we examine his theology, and I guess we'll also have to talk about his philosophy, because he's both a theologian and a philosopher, where would you put Jonathan Edwards on the spectrum in his day? Where would he have fallen? You called him a Puritan preacher,
yeah,
a Puritan theologian. What did that mean then?
Well, I think preeminently it means many of the things that we would affirm today. For example, a belief that a person truly needed to be converted, that there was a new birth required, following John 3:3, that this was something one didn't become a Christian sort of by association or gradually or, by training, but that there was a real renovation of the heart that was required. And this was certainly a Puritan conviction. And, of course, a sense of biblical authority, that the place that one went for the substance of the faith was the pages of Scripture. As a Puritan, the term is a little bit anachronistic by the time Edwards comes along. He was born in 1703. This is, in fact, his... what does that make it? His tercentenary year, I suppose. And, in fact, John Wesley was born the same year. But by that time, it was a few generations into the Puritan presence on this continent, and Puritanism was being challenged. For example, at Yale, where Edwards went for his college education, by various flavors of, I suppose, Enlightenment science, Enlightenment philosophy. And Edwards very much provides a synthesis, a kind of adaptation while maintaining the heart of Puritan theology, but sort of restating things in new terms for folks who, many of whom were tempted away from the faith altogether by some of the things, say, that they were reading in their college years, a familiar phenomenon.
Was he only a preacher? How else did he contribute at the time, not only to the Great Awakening, but to the religious climate of the United States?
Well, he contributed not only, as you say, as a preacher, but as a person who wanted to understand the dynamics of revival, of what was happening in his own town among the people that who were being affected in these revivals, both in America and eventually abroad in, say, the Methodist revival in England and other things going on in Germany and other countries at the time. And he particularly focused on religious experience. What did it mean when people had certain experiences, particularly emotional experiences, when they were involved in these revivals? And so he really acted as something of a scientist of the spirit, I suppose. He would come and, you know, he would ask penetrating questions about, you know, what people experienced in their conversion. People would tell him their conversion stories, and he eventually wrote a book called A Treatise on the Religious Affections, which was an attempt to see, you know, what were the real signs that God was savingly working in a person's heart.
Why did this question of conversion, this question of determining the authenticity of one's conversion or of one's faith, why did this question continue to ring so loudly with Jonathan Edwards?
Well, it was a long-standing question for Puritans. The Calvinist belief that God operates without, you know, that He predestines folks to conversion, to salvation, that really there's nothing that we can do on our own to make ourselves Christians, even so much as sort of making a decision, that it's all from grace, that it's all God, you know, drawing us. Well, if you really believe that, and the Puritans certainly did, then you begin to really need to look for signs. You want to know, okay, you know, if there's nothing I can do to make myself a Christian, how do I know if I'm one of the elect, if God really is savingly working on my heart? You see, it's a matter of the utmost importance, and often, you know, the sort of one of the caricatures of Puritans is that they were perpetually tortured by this notion that perhaps they weren't among the elect and some were driven mad and so forth. I don't think that it's really quite as grim as all that. They had a hardy doctrine of you know, a sense that one could get an assurance personally of one's salvation and that there were certain signs you could look to. But you can see how that developed. If it's all God's doing, how do you tell if God's doing it?
Was Edwards in any sense an apologist for the Calvinist theological positions?
Yes, he certainly was. You know, he wrote some of his philosophical works were really attempts to talk to the modern, to the enlightened sort of modern man, enlightened in the sense of, you know, touched by Enlightenment philosophy, and say, you know, the God who predestines some and not others is not a monster. This is a loving God, and sort of to reconcile this, the charge of say the deists in England, for example, was that you know, any God who could choose arbitrarily from a human perspective one person and not another must be a terrifying and really a cruel God. And much of you know, Edwards became convinced early in his adolescence. This was a troubling doctrine for him, and he eventually became convinced that, in fact, you know, this was a loving God, and that just because we couldn't always explain, you know, the things that he did, doesn't mean that he's a monstrous being. And so he wrote books on the freedom of the will, on defending the doctrine of original sin, and so forth.
Now, one of the things I found interesting, coming at it from a pastor's perspective, is Edwards' determination early in his pastoral ministry not to do what was in vogue in that day, and that is to go to the homes of all of his parishioners and visit and in a sense, get to know them. He determined to simply preach, to write, and to deal with the people only in their time of need. Why did he make this decision, and what was the result?
Well, he, you know, I think that this is a good example of somebody who discerns their own gifts well, and who decides to be obedient in the things that the Lord has called him to do. He was like many Puritans. He diarized. He thought extensively, meditated on, you know, how he was doing as a Christian, and also on who he was as a person, on his own strengths and weaknesses. And through this process, he really felt that he was discerning that he didn't have the kind of social ease and social graces that some of the successful ministers did in his time, that he wasn't able to bring conversations around quickly to the things of God in the course of a social setting. He was uncomfortable in some of these settings. And on the other hand, if he discerned, which was true, a real, he wouldn't have put it this way, but a real brilliance, a real clarity of thought, and an ability to write, to think through theology, and to write things that were helpful to folks. And to this we have to add that he was not... he was a sympathetic character. He can seem cold, you know, when we hear about a decision like that. But he really... he had... 10 sisters and 11 children. All the signs that we have is that they had, you know, a very close, loving relationship. His own theology was a theology of the heart. He was concerned very much with the relational side of the Christian life, and so he did. You know, when he ministered to people in their need, they would testify frequently to how much of an impact this had on their lives. And I don't think there were a lot of folks who faulted him at the time for his decision to operate the way he did as a pastor.
And what was the result of this approach to his congregation?
Well, there were some in the congregation. You know, he was compared. He, I guess, had the misfortune of following the act of a remarkable preacher, his own grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, whose influence was so strong in the Connecticut Valley up into Massachusetts that he was known as sometimes the Pope of the Connecticut Valley. And he had a much more kind of a vibrant social style, and there were folks in the congregation who compared the two of them and felt that that Edwards just wasn't... that he was a bit of an elitist, that he was a bit cold, and they had other reasons to be concerned about him. He was a man of principle, and became convinced about halfway through his ministry at Northampton that some of the folks who were becoming members and taking communion really shouldn't have been in the church, and he wanted to set some limits to membership and some criteria, and church going. You have to understand that in order to be socially successful in his day in New England, you had to be a church member. You could not hold, for example, judicial positions or public office unless you were a member of the church. And so, among some of the perhaps less you know, more nominal members of the church who nonetheless were very had a lot of social power, there was a growing move against Edwards, and it eventually resulted in his being ejected from the congregation in 1750.
Now, this is kind of outlined the two phases of his career, the kind of the Great Awakening phase, in which things came very hot and heavy, and one might say a pretty successful, comfortable life, to what it sounds, at least in the magazine, like a degree of exile. What followed his ejection from that congregation?
Well, initially he didn't know, and he had, I'm not sure if all of his, I believe all of his children had been born at that time. He has, I think, 9 at home at that point. I think his older daughter had married. And he's very alarmed. He does believe that you know, God is in charge, and that these all things are going to work together for good. But here he is, you know, a man in his you know, getting on in years, past his just passing, I suppose, into his upper middle age, and he considered offers from Presbyterian churches in Scotland. He considered offers to teach college. And eventually he took a small charge, really a mission church, in Stockbridge on the western frontier of Massachusetts, where many in his congregation were the Indians in the area. And there were a few you know, a few white members of the congregation as well. And so he enters a rather interesting part of his career where he's splitting his time between preaching to this small frontier congregation and indeed writing what many scholars today believe is some of the most profound philosophical and theological writing that's ever been done by an American. So he wrote some of it on scraps of paper that were sewn together because he couldn't, you know, he was on the frontier, paper was hard to come by, and he wasn't getting paid a whole lot. But he felt that this too was in the providence of God, and he had a great impact in this phase of his career as well, though not directly so much as a revivalist.
So more hands-on in the first part of his career. In the second part of his career, probably his most prolific thinking and writing took place, from which we have benefited today, but out on the fringes of the action.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you think about the great minds of Europe at the time and the conditions that they were working under and producing their philosophical works, and here you have this great mind sort of stranded out on the frontier and writing these profound works. It's really a fascinating story.
I'm still trying to form a picture with respect to, because my prejudices come into play. It's hard to see the First Great Awakening without looking at it through the lens of the Second Great Awakening, which was an altogether different animal. We'll talk about it a little bit in a minute. But I'm trying to get a picture of not only the man, but of the event as well. It sounds as though those things that typified the Second Great Awakening were not present yet in the First Great Awakening.
Right. I mean, we can't think of the First Great Awakening in terms, for example, of mass revival meetings or outdoor meetings or really even a high degree of emotion in preaching. It is more really, Edwards is the progenitor of the tradition of local church revivals. I mean, that's where things were really happening. The meetings were at the church in Northampton. There was certainly much discussion in the streets and in the houses and in the families, but where the action was taking place was still within the four walls of the church. And there was less, I suppose, of what might be called technique. It was a sense that this was a surprising work of God. Those were the words that Edwards used, where one preached a fairly straightforward message, you know, a doctrinal message, and this aroused folks' concerns, and it went from there.
We're talking with Chris Armstrong, managing editor of Christian History Magazine, published in Carroll Stream, Illinois, about the theme of their latest edition of Christian History, Jonathan Edwards, the warm-hearted genius behind The Great Awakening. If you'd like information on how to receive Christian History Magazine, you can call them toll-free at 1-800-873-6986. That's 1-800-873-6986 and ask to receive Christian History Magazine. Or you can contact Christian History via the Internet. Go to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find a direct link to Chris Armstrong and Christian History Magazine. The phone number again, 1-800-873-6986, 1-800-873-6986. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Chris about Jonathan Edwards. He had mentioned before this religious psychology, this desire to know how it went about in a person's heart and mind, conversion, faith, assurance. We'll talk about a treatise on religious affections when we come back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence. because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer and faithful adults in India who listen to small children asking, why did their mother and father leave them? At-risk children need Christ's hope. Orphan girls and boys wanting an education fill the campus of Ramabai Mukti Mission in the city of Pune, India. Each child has escaped a background filled with poverty, which may have included abuse and illness. And yet the campus is filled with happy sounds of praise music and Bible lessons. One house mother, known as a matron mother, described how a five-year-old girl wanted to grow up and become a police officer. Her aunt beat her mother, and she said she wanted to stop abusive situations in the future. Support the children of Mukti with your prayers for their healing and their future. Learn how to pray by calling 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461. Ask for prayer guidelines for India.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. This month, Yale University Press will publish a paperback titled Doing School. It's by Denise Clark Pope from her dissertation, Doing School, How We Are Creating a Generation of Stressed Out, Materialistic, and Miseducated Students. Fred Rogers died last week. Come on, Mr. Rogers, I used to think when I'd pass by my kids watching TV. Don't speak so slowly. Get on with it. Dr. Ken Haller of the St. Louis University School of Medicine said that Mr. Rogers' slow approach really let kids think for themselves. It let them answer back to the screen and think about how they were feeling. There's the contrast. My way, our adult way of hurrying children through all the things we imagine they absolutely have to do, doing school, versus the slower way. Letting children interact with adults in a way that lets children progress in true learning. A lovely day in the neighborhood. Might that difference come down to this? We don't always respect children as individuals created by God to live their lives, not our lives. I'm Dale Meyer. Thanks for joining me.
Did you know that every hour of every day, children have to leave their homes because they are not safe? Where will they go? Who will care for them until it is safe for them to return home? You can provide a temporary safe home for children by becoming a foster parent with the Missouri Division of Family Services. You can be the answer to these questions and make a difference in the life of a child. For more information, please call the Missouri Division of Family Services. The children are waiting.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll hear from the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March called Confession and Forgiveness. That will be the subject of our conversation with Ted Kober of Peacemaker Ministries tomorrow on the program. Also, military chaplaincy. Dr. Dan Gard of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will talk to us about that. That is a timely topic that I think everyone should be interested in, especially those who know someone or have someone close to them who is headed overseas in the military. And we'll talk with Dr. Thomas Manteuffel of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis about Islam, another timely topic on Issues Etc. tomorrow. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Chris Armstrong is our guest of Christian History Magazine. Chris, there's a whole section in the magazine about the religious psychology of Jonathan Edwards, and you mentioned before that he was acutely concerned about what was going on in this thing that came to be called the Great Awakening. What were his conclusions?
Well, he went through several phases of study. I mean, one thing that was obvious to folks who were observing the awakening was that there was a certain amount of emotion involved. People were weeping. They were, even though, as I say, he was not a particularly dramatic preacher, he wasn't, to all appearances, trying to stir up the crowd. that folks were responding to the message, simply the message of the gospel, it seems, in ways that were unusual, not only weeping, sometimes even laughing or falling to appearances unconscious, things that have been seen in subsequent revivals. And, you know, this was happening as well on the other side of the ocean with the Wesleyan revival. And this was an age of empiricism. The writings of John Locke had encouraged folks to think about the ways that we know what we know as being related to what comes from our senses. You know, John Locke used the image of a tabula rasa, a blank slate. We're born a blank slate, and we come to know things, to gain knowledge by our experiences. And this was considered true for Christians as well, that there's a kind of experiential knowledge, not that it intends to conflict with or offer revelations that are not present in Scripture. Edward certainly repudiated that notion, but that we know God not only with our minds, but also in what he called our religious affections.
So it sounds as though he was trying to strike a balance somewhere between the Methodism of Wesley as it was finding its way into the United States and the cold kind of calculated intellectualism of Enlightenment religious types.
Yeah, I would say that that's fair, except that I think that you would have found Wesley attempting to strike the same balance. I mean, there were certainly enthusiasts on the edges of both movements on both sides of the ocean. And, this is the way people like Charles Old Brick Chauncey, the respected minister of the First Church in Boston, this is the kind of charge they leveled against as they were becoming known, evangelicals under Wesley and Edwards, that they were enthusiasts. Literally, that means they had a mad belief that one is directly inspired by God and that that's where a lot of this emotion comes from. At the same time, So Edwards argues certainly that this isn't the intention of the revival, and this isn't what most folks are really involved in. And on the other hand, he argued that there was a kind of coldness and a kind of intellectual focus in much of the religion of the day that was equally unhealthy and that was a missing of what the Christian life was really about. And so he was trying to strike a balance between two extremes.
His notion of happiness I found interesting in this issue of Christian history. One evaluator even refers to him as a hedonist in a good sense of the term. What was Edwards' view of happiness? Something to be eschewed? Something that's irrelevant to religious experience?
Well, that's an interesting question. This great magnum opus on religious psychology, what we would call now religious psychology, his treatise concerning the religious affections, he wrote that it was first published in the 1740s after the second of the revivals, and the key verse, really the sermon text, I suppose, of the book is 1 Peter 1:8, whom having not seen ye love, in whom, though now ye see him not, yet believing, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. And he looked at passages like that and said, hey, you know, joy is an expectable part of the Christian life. If you're not experiencing it, there's perhaps something wrong here. And he himself, in his conversion and in his spiritual life, enjoyed seasons of what he characteristically called sweetness in communion with God. Often out in nature, he would be sitting, sort of watching a thunderstorm or walking in the woods or what have you, and would really feel a sweet sense of communion. And this to him was, again, a religious affection, something that wasn't simply feeling. There was a very rational component to it because you served a God who was a reasonable God. But it was an acknowledgement that God engages the whole self. You're not really about the business of religion, as he put it, if you're only interested in doctrine.
Was this, although you do, it is mentioned in the magazine several times, that if one sat for the average sermon of Jonathan Edwards, they would have found something very cogent and doctrinal, wouldn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was always there at the center. You know, I don't think we could even call him a Puritan unless he had been, widely read and deeply knowledgeable in theology. The Puritans were interested, if nothing else, in really understanding, as Calvin had been, how Christian theology fit together, what God wanted us to know, not just feel, about, who we are as human beings and how we relate to God. So this was, he was a philosopher, if nothing else, but not perhaps the kind of cold, distant, academic person that we might associate sometimes with the term philosopher. He was a warm-hearted man, genuinely.
Was this something, this emphasis on both the soundness of doctrine and the centrality of Christian doctrine and Christian affections, as he would have referred to it, was this something that he drew from classic Calvinism, or was this something that he found needful for his day to say, okay, this is something we need to append to our traditional theology?
Yeah, I mean, his sense of, his theory or his doctrine of the spiritual sense that he believed people received when they became Christian, he talked about it as something like the taste of honey. If you don't have it, it's very difficult to describe. People, he says, who God is working on savingly, they have a new sense of Scripture. They read with a new joy and a new insight. They have a new viewpoint on their own lives and on the society around them and so forth. And this is a very, very much a heart thing. It's not merely an intellectual thing. And it was a notion that came from John Calvin. Calvin had been called the sensus suavitas, a sense of God's beauty or sweetness or holiness that the saints actually apprehend or taste. So in this sense, he was very much in Calvin's debt when he used this kind of language.
Now, I'd like to speak a little bit about Edwards as a missionary. The second phase of his life was spent in what would be called today ethnic ministry among the Indians of the area, the Native American people of the area. Is he in some sense a missionary figure as well?
Yes, that's fair to say. And he, I suppose his real legacy here, interestingly enough, wasn't his own ministry to these folks so much as he developed a friendship with a young minister named Brainerd, who, as a young man, had gone into to minister to these Indians in on the frontier. And Brainerd, in fact, had fallen in love with Edwards's daughter, and his daughter nursed him through his last illness. Unfortunately, he passed away as a result of illness that he contracted while working out in this frontier area. But still today, this the diary and the biography of Brainerd has been an inspiration for generations of missionaries, and a really important part of the missionary legacy of America. He also turns his mind to whether God sometimes speaks to folks who've never been exposed to the gospel, and kind of has a notion of holy pagans. I don't think he ever, took it to the final step and said you could be a Christian without having heard of Christ, but he observed among the Indians to whom he ministered a kind of, perhaps nobility, perhaps it's a little naive, but a sense that there was some real natural virtue here, and that there was a predisposition to godliness, which could only be explained by a notion of general revelation of general grace. And so really at the end of his life, he begins entertaining notions that were very much different from what perhaps the Calvinist tradition would have taught, just because of his experience with these Indians. It's really interesting. Gerald McDermott has a wonderful article on this called Holy Pagans in the issue.
Looking into that, it seems that there are two things in tension in Edwards' thinking. One, the possibility of holy pagans, And I have to admit, quite honestly, that I find that a little disturbing about Edwards. But at the same time, his ability to deplore the religion of the Indians, and even to refer to them as the devil's captives.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that, you know, we confuse things today in the West and for the last century and more by using a term religion as if, everything that fit under that category was the same sort of thing. And Edwards was very clear to make the distinction. I don't think he believed that God was necessarily talking to these Indians through their native religions. I think, as you said, he really identified many of their religious, what we would call, quote, religious practices as being very, very demonic and very misleading.
You've mentioned several times his delight in the created world, in seeing God's fingerprints in the created world, what theologians would probably call natural revelation. Did he share the skepticism of someone, connected with this last question we were entertaining, mm-hmm. did he share the skepticism of someone who would say, one could know only so much of God in the natural world, his majesty and his beauty, but beyond that, saving knowledge through natural revelation would be impossible?
Oh, certainly, yeah, I think he would have agreed with that. He did. I mean, getting back to the question of his joy and his joyfulness, I think he would have said that once you knew, not only could you only know us. Well, let's back up a little. You could not have a saving knowledge through nature, but once saved, this was a sort of a deep well to which he returned again and again. Just a sense of the presence of God. Uplifting and sustaining all of creation at every moment. He even at one point developed a notion that God sort of entirely recreates the world every second. He so suffuses everything that we see around us. And he's a bit of a mystic in that way, I think. It's funny perhaps to think of him that way, but he really is.
You don't think of the Puritans as being mystics.
You don't think of it that way, but he was, and I think it's kind of a winning facet of his personality when you begin to look at it.
Considering his Puritan roots, how much do you think his positions, the evolution of his theology, his philosophy, is due to the fact that he was, what, fourth or maybe fifth generation Puritan in America?
Yes.
And in the American nation with its own sensibilities?
Well, I'm not sure if I get all of what you're getting at there, but I mean, clearly the fact that he was a fourth or fifth generation, that there were other preachers in his background, that we mentioned his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, It prepares him for his years at Yale, when, as I say, some of his colleagues, the other students there, are really slipping pretty quickly into a kind of rational Anglicanism and thence into the deistic view of the clockmaker God, who really has no personal contact with his creation. Edwards is much more inclined to value the legacy that he's been given, and to try to express it and formulate it in new ways. He had just a wonderfully curious, really a scientific mind. But he was in many senses a conservative. He was dedicated to conserving that legacy of particularly Calvinist theology that had been passed on to him through these generations of Puritans.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Jonathan Edwards or the First Great Awakening, you can give us a call. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Chris Armstrong of Christian History Magazine is our guest. Chris, put it in the simplest terms then, by way of summarizing what we've said up to this point. How did this gifted thinker and preacher, granted, how did this person serving two small congregations in what would amount to a pretty short ministry today, by the length of standards, died early from mm-hmm. tragic circumstances. How did he become, in time, the patriarch of evangelicalism in America?
Well, there's a process, as other revivals occur, as other ministers are working in America, trying to have a lively church and to spread the gospel, they keep referring back to Edwards. I mean, he was a his family not only featured many preachers, but they were really a very influential family. His writings were influential, and he was somebody that folks looked to. At the very end of his life, he was asked to be the president of Princeton, and in fact, you mentioned his death from tragic circumstances. He died of a smallpox injection after a couple of months as the president of Princeton. But, he was a very high-profile person, despite, as you say, some of the limits in scope in his ministry, and not least through his writings. And his writings and his thought about what revival looked like and its shape and what one might expect in times of religious revival really do shape the thinking and the practice of generations of evangelists and preachers and revivalists in both America and abroad.
You do refer to him as the patriarch of evangelicalism, and I think the case is made in Christian history there, but it still leaves the question somewhat unanswered as to who exactly today in American evangelicalism are his legitimate successors. Or I guess that's perhaps too broad. Who are really following in his footsteps?
Well, I think to come back to these keynotes of both Puritanism and evangelicalism, of conversion, of a revival, of biblical authority, a warm-hearted faith that touches all areas of personal and social life, I think everywhere you find folks who would take perhaps a centrist position and not perhaps run too much after the phenomena of sometimes accompanying revival, or not wishing to retreat into a more rationalist version of the faith, a fairly broad middle might consider itself in the following in the footsteps of Jonathan Edwards. One thinks of some such obvious people as Billy Graham. And I think the term that's often used, although it's less and less useful, is evangelical, that folks who are working in an evangelical tradition can look to Edwards as a kind of a father, as a patriarch.
Edwards certainly could not anticipate the Second Great Awakening, but I'm curious, in to your mind, if he were to have lived to see such a thing, how would he have evaluated the Second Great Awakening with its emphasis on new measures and technique over the emphases that he had in the First Great Awakening?
Yeah, I think he would have been concerned by some of the ways in which people felt that they could kind of stir up a revival, or even the use of the term a revival, as if this was something you could put together in a package and create. I think sometimes the stress on the difference between, say, a Charles Finney and Jonathan Edwards is a little bit overdone. Finney himself is reviled as this sort of artificer of revival who creates measures and believes he can stir folks up almost by power of rhetoric. Finney himself used often metaphors of, say, planting seed and harvesting, which acknowledge that there's a part of the process that is beyond human capability, that God works here. And so I think, there would have been a mixture of some concern on Edwards's part with some of this technique, but also a willingness to celebrate where he really would have seen God at work in these later revivals.
I take it then Edwards probably would have turned up his nose at the notion that one could schedule a revival for the coming weekend.
Well, yeah, I think the term revival used with that definite that indefinite article, or the definite article before it, say a revival, that would have felt a little artificial to Edwards, or maybe more than a little. He really did feel that this was in the end a surprising work of God, and that a sovereign God would revive folks where he saw fit. One could certainly pray for this, and God might well hear your prayers, but to say it's all going to happen this weekend, that would have certainly been going too far for him.
You mentioned Charles Finney and the Second Great Awakening. Is Finney, in some sense, even with all of his emphasis on technique, is Finney indebted to Edwards in the sense of religious psychology, or the Christian affection?
He certainly was. I mean, he comes across as a rationalist, but in my own study of Finney, I think he's unaware of the depth of his own debt to Edwards. You know, Finney always said that you had to reason with people first, and that, you know, any emotion that followed was kind of a secondary phenomenon. But that's not exactly the way that he preached. If you hear his preaching, it was very much geared to touch the heart. You know, we can argue about whether sometimes that was he went overboard, whether it was some of it was a bit of kind of artifice of stirring folks up, but if you read his memoirs, he was very convinced of the need for Christians to be touched in their hearts, and of the importance of the religious affections. He's conflicted about it in part, I think, because by the time you hit the 1830s and 40s in America, the mind really is king, and there's not much room for a public emotion. It's kind of looked down upon.
How would Jonathan Edwards evaluate the revivalism of today in particular, but evangelicalism of today in general?
Well, I think he perhaps would have been a little shy of some of the mass revivalism that takes place. He was really, he very strongly emphasized the local church. His heart was a pastor's heart. I think he very much stressed that ministry takes place through relationships, even as we've said that he sometimes felt he was less than adequate to that task. And you might have been concerned with some of the mass culture phenomenon that's coming, the televangelism, the mass meetings that have come to characterize certain parts of evangelicalism. That's one thing that comes to mind.
Chris Armstrong, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you for having me.
Chris Armstrong is managing editor of Christian History Magazine. It's published in Carroll Stream, Illinois. The theme of the latest issue, and I do recommend this magazine for your reading, folks, very informative, especially in its focus on individuals like Jonathan Edwards, lifted the veil from my eyes to a great degree reading this one. The latest issue deals with Jonathan Edwards, the warm-hearted genius behind the Great Awakening. Now, if you would like to have Christian History Magazine for your very own, you can call them toll-free, 1-800-873-6986. That's 1-800-873-6986. Ask to receive Christian History Magazine, or you can contact Christian History via the Internet. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the Links with Regular Guests link, and there you'll find Chris Armstrong and Christian History Magazine. Their phone number again, 1-800-873-6986. When we come back from this break, Pastor Tim Pauls, associate pastor and acting school administrator at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Boise, Idaho, author of an article in a recent edition of Higher Things magazine titled "Don't Drink the Water," will tell us what he means when he compares the church to a boat. And then a little later, we'll be hearing from Ken Woodward of Newsweek magazine about George W. Bush and the presidents of the last two or three decades and their religious conviction. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.